start. Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing here at the Information Service in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 4th of March. We have a whole briefing pretty focused on Africa, and I would like to start immediately with the UNHCR. Eugene has brought us Patrick Eba, who is the Deputy Director of UNHCR's Division of International Protection, to brief us about the protection and assistance for Congolese fleeing Eastern DRC.
Thank you. You have the floor.
You have to put.
Thank you very much, Alexandra. Dear colleagues, UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, today issued a new position on returns to the Eastern DRC, advising that Congolese nationals fleeing the conflict, as well as those who are outside the country who originate from the areas affected by the conflict, may need refugee protection under international and regional legal frameworks. The security and humanitarian situation in the DRC continues to deteriorate. North and South Kivu provinces remain unstable, with hundreds of thousands of people on the move. Close to 80,000 people have fled armed clashes into neighboring countries. Some 61,000 have arrived in Burundi since January this year. Significant population movements continue inside these provinces. Today, only around 17,000 people are left residing in IDP sites, schools, and churches around Goma, while an estimated 414,000 of their neighbors have been on the move for the past 4 weeks, encouraged by the de facto authorities to return to their villages of origin. At least 209,000 people from these sites have arrived spontaneously in Masisi, Nyaragongo, and Rutshuru territories, where basic services are not equipped for the sudden surge in population arrivals. The Eastern DRC remains one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. Near the front lines, sexual violence and human rights abuses remain rampant, as is the looting and destruction of civilian homes and businesses. In the past 2 weeks of February, an estimated 895 cases of rape, an average of 60 a day, were referred to humanitarian actors for assistance. Explosive remnants of war pose serious risks to children and farmers who are trying to tend to the lands. Humanitarian access to the populations on the move has been restrained by continued clashes, leaving many vulnerable people without access to life-saving aid. Given the widespread insecurity in these provinces and the surrounding areas, many might need to cross borders to find protection and assistance. UNHCR therefore calls on state to register all asylum seekers from the DRC and provide them with documentation. Asylum claims should be processed through fair, transparent, and efficient procedures, including the use of prima facie approaches to recognition, where this is relevant, of course, in accordance with international and refugee law and other relevant legal standards. For Congolese nationals who are outside the country and who are considering voluntarily returning to the Eastern DRC, UNHCR emphasizes the importance of informed decision-making. Individuals should have access to up-to-date and detailed information on the security, governance, and on livelihood in the places of origin where they would like to return, in order for them to make fully informed choices regarding return. there are more than 1 million Congolese refugees across the continent of Africa, mainly in neighboring countries that have shown a long-standing tradition and history of providing protection and assistance to Congolese refugees. We encourage them to continue to uphold their refugee law obligation and their humanitarian commitment. UNHCR calls on the international community to step up support for host countries in providing protection and assistance to refugees from the DRC. I thank you.
Patrick, thank you very much for this introductory remarks. I'll open the floor to questions now. In the room, or is that a hand? Nina, no. Okay. So I don't see hands in the room. Let me see on the platform if there is anybody who wants to ask you a question. I don't see any. So thank you very much. Eugene, you wanted to add anything or no? Okay. So thank you very much. Thanks, Patrick. Oh, okay. You have a question. Okay, go ahead. I think it's for you.
Sorry, Nina Larson with AFP. Thanks for doing the briefing. I was wondering if you could say something about, this is the amount of aid that's needed here, and then the impact that, for instance, the U.S. Decision to cut, to freeze aid funding is having in DRC specifically, if you have any, comments on that. And more broadly, Elon Musk was tweeting yesterday about the fact that no one has died as a result of the aid freeze. I was wondering if you've seen any indications that lacking aid has actually led to deaths. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your question. Like other humanitarian agencies, UNHCR has also been affected by the current freeze. Our focus remains in providing much needed critical humanitarian assistance on the ground. We continue to call on all of our donors to continue to provide support to what is arguably one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. As we see hundreds of thousands of people forcibly displaced, we see critical life-saving needs, and we need as a global community to step up. All countries coming forward to support this important humanitarian situation and ensure that the people have the services and the assistance that they deserve.
Sorry, just on DRC and specifically, has it cut funding specifically to programs that you're working on? Are you missing funds in the DRC and in the response there because of the freeze?
Our humanitarian work in most contexts has traditionally been underfunded, including in the DRC. And so we are still calling for continued support for our work. Again, this is life-saving, critical work for which we need continued support on the part of all government and all actors who can support the government, but also the UN and humanitarian actors in the important work that we do.
Eugene, you wanted to add something?
Thanks, Nina, for your question. So we have to remember one thing before I answer the impact on DRC. DRC, the crisis has been always underfunded. Last year alone, that only 42% was funded. So this has been a decade-long conflict, as well as the funding has been always underfunded. Of course, that we are aware that the U.S. funding freeze, but also we can confirm that we have received a waiver from those 90 suspension, a few emergency countries, including DRC. So we are really appreciate the U.S. decision on the waiver on the DRC operation and an emergency at the moment.
Just one last one. So on the waiver, is it working? Are you getting money through that?
We are hoping that that we can continue to support this emergency. But as I mentioned, that even before the freeze, that this operation, this emergency has been heavily underfunded. So not just the U.S. we're looking, but we're looking at the international community to really step up and support those people in need in DRC and as well as neighboring countries.
Emma.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if we could just move two countries to the east, if that's part of your remit. I wanted to ask about Kenya. There's been reports that food has been reduced in some camps, the Kakuma camp, as a result of the funding cuts. I was wondering, does UNHCR know about that? Can you say what the consequences are on the ground? And more broadly, what do you anticipate to be kind of the broader fallout of aid cuts? This is one example. Thank you.
To answer your question, Emma, on the Kakuma, we are aware the situation at the moment is still fluid, but calmed down a little bit. And we are hearing that there has been injury during the demonstration triggered by refugees, and there has been crashes. We all aware that this has been a trigger because of frustration of a refugee of a food ration cut and overall broader assistance cut. So we're seeing those impact of the funding cut, and also that I have to repeat myself that also that the emergency situation and protracted situation in Kakuma has been also underfunded. So the frustration of a refugee has been long already, and then I think that has triggered this demonstration, but we are following those who are injured, and then we are aware that we are having a discussion with the refugee community, and then together with the WFP to negotiate and discuss with the refugee community on the ground at the moment.
WFP that we will listen to in a moment. Yes, Emma.
And thank you. Do you know the extent of the injuries? Any idea of the scale of the impact?
We know that several individuals sustained injury during the demonstration, specifically on the 3rd of March 2025, including four refugees and a member of local authority, the assistant county commissioner at the moment. But fortunately, there has been no fatality reported.
Thank you very much to all of you. I don't see other hands up. So thank you, Patrick, for coming and briefing the journalists. And we have mentioned WFP, and I have the pleasure to welcome Jean-Martin Bauer, who is the WFP's Director for Food Security and Nutrition Analysis Services. Jean-Martin, you're connecting from Rome to tell us about the situation in Somalia. I'll give you the floor. I'm not sure we can hear you. Can you try and speak, please? No, there is no sound. You want to try again? We should be able to hear you because I don't see you are muted. So, no, there is no sound. Jean-Martin, if it's okay with you, maybe I'll go to the next speaker, and if in the meantime you can disconnect and reconnect, and then we will come to you. Maybe our colleagues in the technical area can I see Alma nodding. So maybe let me go now to WHO. Margaret, you want to come with Dr. Janet Diaz? We are also speaking about Africa here, in particular on the emergency clinical care for people with filovirus infections, diseases in Uganda and in Tanzania, the Marburg virus disease. Dr. Diaz, welcome.
Thank you. Is that working now? Wonderful. Thank you for having me here, and it's my pleasure to discuss a little bit about the filovirus outbreaks happening right now. As you know, Tanzania has been facing a Marburg disease outbreak since the 20th of January, and Uganda has been in the midst of an Ebola outbreak since the 30th of January. I have just been to both countries to support their management of patients, and I will speak to you about that. First, to Uganda. Over the weekend, the Ministry of Health of Uganda announced the death of a 4-year-old child from Ebola. This brings the total number of confirmed patients to 10, including 2 deaths. The outbreak is ongoing, as are all aspects of the response, including investigations to understand the latest chains of transmission. WHO is supporting several aspects of the response, including clinical care, which is why I was deployed. Ebola from the Sudan virus has a case fatality ratio of 40% to 70%. With no licensed treatment yet, early detection, diagnosis, and the best possible supportive care are key to saving lives. With this combination, mortality can be driven down to as low as 10%. In Uganda, I visited the treatment centers in Mulago and Mbale, 2 affected areas, and worked with the health workers and emergency medical teams. The teams are an excellent group of professionals with lots of experience in previous outbreaks. They set up treatment centers in the hotspots within hours of the first case, and the ministry deployed essential medical supplies and equipment to deliver optimized care. My time with them was to focus on improving the standard of care. WHO has worked with partners for years to bring up that standard of care because we have seen how life-saving it is. Standard of care means making sure that patient is in the best health possible, treating them for any co-infections such as malaria or co-infections with bacteria, making sure they have adequate nutrition, hydration, including IV hydration, and balanced electrolytes and sugar levels within their bodies. It also includes improving the circuits and the design of the treatment centers with our new innovative technologies, such as using transparent walls where you can be just outside the red zone and directly communicate with clinicians and monitor patients in the red zone, as well as pass items through the walls with safe connectors. For a strong Ebola clinical response, we need to ensure the right number of people are working in the right functions with sufficient rest. WHO also helped to establish the ICU in Mulago Treatment Center and had previously trained the National Emergency Medical Team, which has deployed. With our logistics colleagues, we supported the organization of the pharmacy and supply inventory system within the treatment center, and it was great to see colleagues from MSF supporting the case management response in the areas of water, sanitation, and infection control and prevention in Mbale. WHO ensured that the trial vaccines and treatments were in the country as part of preparedness even before the outbreak began. The vaccine trial began after the outbreak was declared, and the therapeutics trial protocol is under its last ethical and regulatory review. In the interim, all confirmed patients have received remdesivir under the MURI, otherwise called emergency access use protocols, and this is helping us collect robust clinical data. The goal is to have an effective treatment for Ebola caused by the Sudan virus. And now briefly on Marburg in Tanzania. I deployed to Tanzania before going to Uganda for the Marburg outbreak response, also with a focus on improving patient care. Marburg is clinically similar to Ebola and belongs to the same filovirus family. In this outbreak, there were 2 confirmed and 8 probable cases reported by the Ministry of Health. All 10 cases have died, 8 before the outbreak was declared and detected, 2 died while under care. Once the alert was raised, the clinical workforce deployed to Biharamulo, the affected district, within hours. Many were part of the African Volunteer Corps ad hoc surge emergency responders. When I arrived, they were in the process of installing an ICU to provide more advanced care and had access to medical oxygen monitors and point-of-care laboratory testing. We made sure a clinical care pathway was in place to support early diagnosis and referral to the treatment center, ensuring the proper infection prevention and control and water sanitation and hygiene measures were implemented. Again, here it was good and great to see MSF as a partner providing holistic support to the case management response, highlighting how important collective action amongst partners to support health ministries in response is key. There have been no recent cases, surveillance is ongoing. The countdown is now on to hopefully declare the end of the outbreak in a few weeks. In conclusion, these deployments are always a humbling experience for me, working with clinicians who work in filovirus outbreaks and choose to do so. They are committed, brave, and dedicated to their patients and their peers. WHO provides them with support so that they can be safe while giving their patients even better chances of survival. I want to acknowledge also the R&D blueprint under the leadership of Dr. Ana Maria Henao Restrepo, my colleague. Because of the joint work done with partners in countries, generic protocols are available for filovirus outbreaks, speeding up the launch of vaccine and treatment trials. This is one of the best ways to do even better in the next outbreak to save lives, combined with the highest standard of care. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Diaz. I see Emma Farge from Reuters has a question for you.
Good morning, Dr. Diaz. Thank you very much for the briefing. I'm wondering about U.S. aid cuts and whether they are in any way compromising the surveillance of Ebola in Uganda. I understand that at one point they were helping with screening at the airport, for example. Have other partners been able to step in, and is there any impact at all on surveillance? Thank you.
I'll say one thing and then pass it on to Margaret. I think the U.S. funding freeze has affected key outbreak response capacities for the current Ebola disease outbreak due to Sudan virus in Uganda. WHO has had to step up and cover areas it usually doesn't support, and that does include biological sample transport and logistics and the deployment of surveillance teams to points of entries. This was actually highlighted by our boss, Dr. Mike Ryan, in the past. And WHO has released $3.4 million for contingency fund for emergencies for WHO to support the government-led response. And maybe Margaret wants to add more.
I don't really have anything much more to add. As you know, there's a huge areas of work we're looking at, and we're still really assessing the impacts.
Nina Larsson, AFP.
Thank you. So just to follow up on that, so WHO is stepping in for now, but WHO has also seen quite dramatic funding cuts. How long do you think you can keep that up? Are you seeing anyone else willing to step in? Or, you know, how worried are you that the surveillance or the transport of these samples, you know, might not be able to happen as quickly as it should?
Well, basically, we continue our work. Our work is to ensure that the highest level of health is achieved by all people. And changes in funding, changes in donation, of course, are big challenges. But as the Director General said, we have broadened and looked at broadening our funding base. We've gone through transformation. And we won't let the people of the planet down. We just have to be more innovative. We have to talk to different partners, and we're doing all that.
Sorry, just on a broader question, I was wondering, since you're looking at health around the world also, the fact that the funding freeze from the U.S. has impacted quite a dramatic number of programs. Have you seen signs that people are actually dying from the lack of assistance that they're receiving? Because, like I mentioned earlier, Elon Musk yesterday was saying that that is not true, that no one has died due to this. I'm just wondering if you guys have seen, what is the specific impact on the ground of these funding cuts? Thanks.
So essentially, it would be much too early to make those kind of assessments. You really wouldn't see those. You wouldn't be able to quantify anything like that for quite some time from now. You wouldn't be able to say yes, you wouldn't be able to say no, because you'd have to do a proper evaluation. But our job is to make sure that no matter what happens, people's health is protected. And yeah, it's a challenging time, but we're going to continue doing everything we can to help the people of the planet.
I see on the platform Jamie Keaton, AAP.
Thank you, Alessandra. I'm actually walking over to the briefing room now, so please bear with me. I want to just continue to press on what both Emma and Nina have just discussed. Margaret, you mentioned that you're still assessing. We've been hearing that for weeks. What can you tell us specifically now about what impacts have happened? I'm surely you know, there have been these waivers that have been discussed, but can you be really specific about, I know that it's too early maybe to assess the health impacts, but in terms of funding, in terms of deployments, in terms of staffing, can you give us more specifics on what has been, even though it's still in progress, can you please tell us up to now what specifically has been affected?
Thanks, Jamie. And I got your email this morning, so you asked that very question by email already. And essentially, I passed it on because we're a huge organization. As I said, our mandate is to achieve the highest level of health for every person on this planet. So we've got many, many, many programs. And in your email, you said, oh, many other organizations have said specifically, a lot of organizations maybe have one specific role, so it's easier for them to quantify what the impact is. But I can mention, for instance, the measles surveillance network, charmingly called Gremlin. It's the global rubella measles surveillance, but it does surveillance on yellow fever, Japanese encephalitis, as well as measles rubella and many other. And that was 100% funded by the US. And so, again, we're not going to let it collapse, but finding a way to keep it going is, of course, challenging.
Thank you very much, Margaret. Let me see. Oh, Jamie has a follow-up. Oh, no, it was, the hand is gone. So Catherine Fiancon, France 24.
I'm here.
Oh, no, it wasn't gone. Okay, go ahead.
Sorry, I'm literally about to walk into the room. If you hold on 1 second, I will ask this in person if I can get into the room.
Yeah, maybe, Jamie, why don't you do that? Oh, here, you are here.
Right,
okay.
Here.
Okay,
on,
that's
right
the first time we have you live.
Hello, everyone.
Walk in the corridors. Go ahead, ask your follow-up, and then I go to Catherine.
Thank you. Margaret, just to follow up on that, please. You say you'll do everything that you can, but if you don't have funds and you don't have staff that are available to deploy to these places, then you may have good intentions. So can you please try to give us as much specifics as possible about, I know that it's a big organization, you just finished saying that, but what I'm talking about is specifics right now based on specific areas. You mentioned the measles, which is a positive one, but let's get the ones that are not being helped. Let's get into the areas where there have been shortfalls. Can you be specific about that?
No, the measles is where there's a big shortfall. That's what I meant. But we're going to do what we can. And this is the same with every area where we're seeing a shortfall. We're looking at what can we do, what other partners can step in. It may be that there are things that we can't do that we ask a partner to do. But the point of us, the point of us, is to coordinate every effort to support the health of the people on this planet. So not having money to do what we normally do is a massive struggle, yes. But we're not going to just sit there and weep. You know, we're not going to just give up. We are now looking at what funding we've lost where and who can step in and what can be done. But I do not have specifics.
Sorry, this one's for Dr. Diaz. Thank you so much for coming to see us. You mentioned on two occasions, I think, in your initial remarks about MSF as a partner. MSF, if I understand it correctly, is in particular one NGO that several years ago opted not to accept U.S. funding. So I'm wondering, are you finding that MSF's role in general is becoming more and more important in terms of their ability to as a partner to do to take actions like the ones that you mentioned?
Thanks for the question. It's a really good one. You know, MSF has always been a strong partner, as many other NGOs that we work with in the medical response, you know, in the humanitarian responses. So they've been with us through every Ebola filovirus outbreak in different countries. And I think their role is their committed role. They're always there. You know, I don't know the details of their funding sources, but I know they are reliable and present and willing to support WHO and the ministries of health and their response, and they're reliable. So I think to do an effective response requires collective action from different partners in a coordinated manner, you know, to fulfill the strategic objectives of the ministry. And so, and we need to bring everyone's, what would you say the advantage that everyone has, right? That the comparative advantage of the different organizations that are participating and collaborating, and I think the key is to do that well, right? Is to coordinate well, is to be efficient in that way, and I wanted to highlight one thing. To your other question, maybe one of the areas of work that I currently lead on is also the clinical side in safe, scalable care, but also the infection prevention and control and WASH side. And that part of the work did have, for emergencies, a large amount of U.S. funding, and the freeze has affected that. And we are concerned about what that means for health emergencies, right, where infection prevention and control and WASH, you know, water, sanitation, all those things, access, are really key interventions. And so a lot of thinking now and trying to find, you know, be efficient. How can we still deliver with less? Who can we work with? Again, optimize partnerships, collaborations with other agencies to be able to deliver and find other donors. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Catherine Fiancon, France 24.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. Good morning to the ladies. Yes, in fact, it's a follow-up to the questions of my colleagues. We know that WHO is doing a wonderful job for many, many years. And that is the reason why I think most of us are very anxious about what's happening, because we've seen on the field the effects and of your actions. But I'd like to come back to the questions of my colleagues in asking, what do you see? For instance, apparently in the field in Bangladesh, they already see the impact. In DR Congo, apparently also due to the lack of fund, there is the response is slowing down. So Akanu did request with a letter to Fadela and Gabriela a briefing on that issue. I think it's important for the Geneva Press Corps to know exactly what Jamie said previously. What are the risks? Do you have options? Have you found ideas out of the box to help you find new funding? Because you cannot wait forever. And as you said, Margaret, you cannot sit and weep. it's not, I would say, le genre de la maison. But are there options? Can you, because we've seen also with the cutting of USAID, that USAID was even funding NGOs based in Geneva and funding things that we didn't know they were funding. So what are the solutions? And I reiterate the kind request of Akanu to have a briefing on that issue on or off the record in order to better understand what are the options and the risks in the field. Thank you so much.
I think that was for me, but yes, indeed, that we are organising that briefing. I know Fidela's been contacting all the various people to get that briefing organised for you.
John Zarokostas, The Lancet, and François Enquatre.
Good morning. Can you hear me there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you hear me? Yes. Yes, following up on my colleague's questions, Margaret, can you elaborate a little bit if you have a bird's eye view of the breakdown? During the executive board, the emergencies departments gave us clear picture on what was the situation in the emergencies division with up to 25% of the programs affected across the board. Do we know what's the impact in the non-emergency divisions on primary healthcare, on NCDs? What is the impact there? Because there the multiplier is global. And I have a second question on another issue. Thank you.
Can you give us your both questions, John, please, so that we can answer?
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Fine. The second question is if the WHO, perhaps I've missed it, have you put out a comment on the abduction of 130 patients in Goba by the M23 Rwandan-backed rebels? Thank you.
John, I don't have anything on the abduction of the patients. I'll check that out for you, but I don't have any information on that at the moment. again, program by program, that's exactly what we're assessing. And yes, I know it sounds like we're slow, but our funding is such a mixed picture. Some departments do have, there's a bigger impact on some departments than others, but also it's a matter of then looking at where else in the organisation you get funding, how you get that funding, how you move it around. So and again, as I said, we are not going to let any patient, any person who needs our help down. So one way or another, we are going to continue.
And John, I don't know if you saw yesterday, the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights also put out a statement on the abduction of these people from these hospitals. So just referring you to that if you haven't seen it. Paula Dupraz, Geneva Solutions.
Hi, good morning. Just to follow up on all those questions regarding the impact of the cuts in funding on people on the ground, I'm wondering if you could speak specifically about how that may have impacted your partners that are involved specifically in information management and data, you know, data collection and data analysis. There are a number of organizations such as IMAP, Impact Initiatives, various other organizations. How has funding been to those organizations been impacted?
I'm sorry, I really don't have information on that at all, but if you could send that to me as an email, I'll pass it on and see if I can get anything from you. But again, if we're talking about other organisations, they are the ones who can describe how they're impacted. But if you're saying we fund them and the funding is coming from us, certainly if you put it specifically in an email, I'll do my best to try to find some answers for you. But no promises.
Thank you very much to everyone. Thanks, Dr. Diaz, for being with us. Thanks, Margaret. I see that the World Food Programme colleague is reconnected. Jean-Martin, I think you are back. And maybe this
time... I'm back.
Yeah,
back. Can you hear me?
And this time we can hear you. That's great.
Fantastic.
Please go ahead with your briefing. That's about Somalia worsening hunger situation.
No, it is. And the reason I'm here today is to convey our concern about the situation in Somalia, which is facing increased food insecurity in the next few months. I'd like to get into some detail with you all. We have new data from the IPC, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification System. A recent report estimated that about 3.4 million people are currently facing acute food insecurity in Somalia. That's going to rise to about 4.4 million in the next few months. So that was 3.4 million between January and March. So that's the current number. That number will rise by 1 million between April and June. So that's imminent. And this is significant because of the level of vulnerability in Somalia. Right now, we have 1.7 million young children in the country who are facing acute malnutrition. And of these, 466,000 are facing severe acute malnutrition. Now, you might remember, those of you who have been in this space for the past few years, that there was a major food crisis in Somalia in 2022. And the same system, the IPC, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, had projected a famine in Somalia in 22. It didn't happen because of a scale-up in assistance. But we're now again seeing patterns that are quite worrisome. First of all, this forecasted increase. But we're worried about the weather going forward. We've had two crops, the gu and the deer crop in 2024 in Somalia, which were not good. They were 45% below the long-term average in both cases. And now we're looking at a poor weather forecast. The different weather models we look at are telling us that there's going to be drought in the next crop cycle, which is going to be the gu cycle, in April to June 2025. That could exacerbate the situation I've just mentioned. I've heard a lot of the journalists on this call ask about funding cuts. And the impact of these funding cuts has not been factored into the numbers I just gave you. So the situation could get worse for both of those reasons, the weather forecast, the funding cuts, and in addition to everything that's going on in Somalia, which includes relatively high food prices and also conflict. Now, what's important also to note is that the World Food Program has already had to curtail its assistance in Somalia. In the month of January, WFP reached about, it's 820,000 people received assistance from us in January. Compare that to a level of 2.2 million per month during our peak period in 2024. So our assistance is down. Our school feeding program is also down. And in fact, in some parts of Somalia, it's been suspended. That's been the case in the Southwest and Banaadir and in Somaliland. So I'd like to close by explaining that what we need in Somalia over the next 6 months is $297 million. We need this to provide assistance to a very vulnerable population. We know that acting early in Somalia is essential. Acting early allows people to mitigate the impacts of the adverse events that we fear, the adverse impacts of this drought that's shaping up in Somalia. We also need to note that in Somalia, unfortunately, the humanitarian response plan in the country is largely underfunded. It's only 12% funded as of now. The overall appeal is for $1.4 billion in the country. So that's the brief I have for you. I am available for questions. Back to you in Geneva.
Thank you very much, Jean-Martin. Let me look at the room here. Nina Larson, AFP.
Yes, thank you very much for the briefing. I appreciate it. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more on your fear, I mean, how serious the situation is, and in light of the likely funding cuts, I mean, you're asking for quite a lot of, you say you need quite a lot of money. What is the likelihood that you'll actually get that in light of the current situation, and what will the impact be if you don't, especially when it comes to children especially? Thank you.
Jean-Martin?
No, thank you. Thank you very much for the question. What's gone on in Somalia is we've had two straight failed seasons. You've had the GU and the DARE in 2024, which were well below average. And we're fearing that with the weather forecast, we'll have another failed season starting in a few weeks. So we need to be prepared for that. And indeed, we're going to need to mobilize more resources. $297 million is a significant amount, and it's what's needed to support the most vulnerable people in Somalia. I mean, we reached more than 800,000 people with assistance in the month of January, but I'd like to focus on the most vulnerable groups. You've got 1.26 million children under the age of five who need support right now, and of those, 466,000 are in severe acute malnutrition. That's where where you've got a high risk of mortality associated with malnutrition. So again, the time to step up is now. We need the resources now. We've learned in Somalia from past experience that delays can be deadly, and we need resources to provide support to these very vulnerable groups.
I have a follow-up, Nina.
Thank you. You're mentioning, the delays are deadly, and to refer back to our previous questions to the others who've been here, the U.S. Funding freeze has caused quite a lot of chaos in the international aid world, and I'm wondering if you've seen specific instances of people who haven't received aid because of that. If you have any specific examples of programs that you're working with that were funded by the U.S. who are no longer receiving funding, if you could give us some examples of that, thank you.
Well, as I mentioned, we have we've curtailed the number of people receiving assistance in Somalia, up from a peak of 2.2 million a month last year, to over 800,000, 800,000 people earlier this year. So that's a decline in the coverage of our programs. Now, what's important to note is that in early February, the in-kind assistance that the U.S. provides to WFP, so that's purchased from U.S. farmers with Title II funds, that was reinstated. And that means that food purchases and deliveries are continuing under existing agreements, and that allows WFP with its partners to continue providing assistance, emergency assistance to people affected by the situation in Somalia, thankfully. Now, what's important is also, my comment today is really about what things look like in Somalia in a few months. We're worried about that. We're worried about the scenario that's playing out. There's, of course, this variable on funding that I've just commented on. But we're also looking at repeated droughts and the increased vulnerability in a very fragile society in a place with a very high baseline of vulnerability. So what we need is for all of our donors to step up. We need all of our partners to step up to provide this assistance to the vulnerable groups in the country.
I'm a Farge writer.
Good morning. Thanks very much for this briefing. This might be a little bit too technical, but it's something I'm interested in. You've cut assistance already quite considerably. I'm wondering if you can say a little bit about those supply chains. Where did those supplies previously come from? Can you say anything about who was giving them? And does this in any way impact the U.S.? Were U.S. farmers, in fact, at the basis of some of those aid supplies for people in Somalia? Thanks a lot.
Well, Somalia overall is a country that relies on imports for the majority of its food supply. It's about 60% import dependent, and WFP programs in Somalia use in-kind imports, but we also do cash programming. So we provide cash transfers to people in the country that meet our vulnerability and targeting criteria. So the supply chain is both in-kind food moving from places like the U.S., but also others where we do international purchases, as well as a significant local boost to the economy through cash-based transfers. So we need to understand that the profile of the operation in Somalia covers both of those. The advantage, of course, with cash transfers is that they're very quick and they provide that boost to the local economy. But when you're facing a crisis like the one we're worried about in Somalia, we need all types of resources to be put at play to avert the worst. Again, we had just 3 years ago a crisis that affected more than 6 million people in Somalia. Right now, the numbers I mentioned are somewhat below that, but the fear is that if the weather forecast remains what it is and we don't get the resources needed to provide the assistance, we'd face a large problem. My colleagues in Somalia tell me that the World Food Program accounts for 85 to 90% of all food assistance in the country. So if we're in trouble, food assistance in Somalia is itself compromised. So again, we're here to tell you that there is a big risk that we're facing right now that can be mitigated in different ways by in-kind food imports, but also cash-based transfers.
Thank you very much. Jimmy Keaton, Associated Press.
Thank you for coming to see us. I would like to just follow up. You mentioned the two things, following up on Emma's question and also what you had said earlier. You mentioned that the in-kind assistance that the United States provides for WFP, so that's a purchase from U.S. farmers with Title II funds. Can you be specific about how much that is, how much that was involved, how much was this was essentially a waiver, if I understand it correctly, that was granted so can you be specific about that? And then just if you could elaborate more on specifically which farmers in the United States may be impacted by these cuts. Thanks.
Okay, so that's a very specific question. I'll have to get back to you with details.
John Zarokostas, France 24 de l'Anse.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for the briefing. I was wondering, sir, the 466,000 children suffering from SAM, how many of these are receiving therapeutic feeding at the moment through your partners? And secondly, in terms of purchasing of food aid, I know traditionally the U.S. has been the biggest supplier to the World Food Program stocks, but are you reaching out for aid packages from other suppliers, for instance, Ukraine, Russia, Australia, as emergency food aid? Thank you.
So, John, the number of children receiving SAM assistance I don't have, but I can tell you that WFP provided nutritious food to about 313,000 people who were at risk of malnutrition in the month of January. So that's actually part of a program that's been prioritized because of the vulnerability of this group. The other sources of supply, WFP has different sources of supply, but I can't really tell you how much has come from the countries you've mentioned, but we don't only bring in food from the U.S. We actually purchase on international markets where the rates are lowest to get the most food and the most bang for our buck, so to speak. So our supply sources tend to be multi-country.
Yeah, Jamie?
Sir, I'm sorry. I'd like to ask you one other quick question, particularly.
Sure.
And thank you for your attempt to the answer before. I will reach out to you in writing for those questions. I wanted to also ask you. We understood from Thompson Fury, who is known to a number of us here in the Geneva Press Corps, yesterday that WFP is going to be closing its Southern Africa office in the wake of the Trump administration. Aid cuts. And I'm just wondering if you could give us a flavor as to whether or not similar other moves are being considered, whether in East Africa or elsewhere, in response to these cuts. Thanks.
Thanks, Jamie. I'm the director of food security analysis. So I'm really here to talk about the vulnerabilities and the needs on the ground. And what we're seeing in Somalia has me worried. It should have us all worried. I can't really comment on details about our field presence at this time.
That's very clear. I think Gabriela Sotomayor, our Mexican journalist from Proceso, also have a question for you, but maybe not for you. We'll see, because I don't think it's specifically on Somalia. Gabriela, you wanted to ask a more general question? I don't see you. Go ahead. Well, you have to unmute yourself, Gabriela.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Alessandra. Do you hear me?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Ah, okay, okay. Yes, my question is that not only Somalia, but a lot of UN programs has been, the United States cut their funds to a lot of UN programs, even they retire for the WHO. So my question is if UN system is kind of kidnapped by the government of Donald Trump.
Maybe I can take this, Gabriela. In general, I think the best answer to your question and also to some of the questions that Jamie and other journalists have asked has been given by the Secretary General in his remarks to the media on the 28th of February. I'm not going to read the whole thing, which is two pages of comments on the information about the severe cuts in funding by the United States. Those two pages contains very concrete examples. For example, you were asking Jamie about health. Secretary General is mentioning in Afghanistan more than 9 million people will miss out on health and protection services, with hundreds of mobile health teams and other services suspended. There are examples on Ukraine, there are examples on even on Mexico, Gabriela. So I think that's really something I would like to report your attention to. But the Secretary General also says that we have been extremely grateful for the leading role the United States has provided over decades. And he gives also examples of what these funds from the United States have been able to do, especially for our humanitarian program. And of course, we look forward to continue working with the United States in this regard. But the Secretary General also, and this is the answer to your question, Gabriela, he also said that we are updating, we are looking, we are analyzing, we are looking, as has been said by my colleagues, to what needs to be done on this and on the other project. Especially, he made a reference to the Interagency Standing Committee that, as you know, brings together also the NGOs, just all the our partners in the humanitarian activities, not just the UN agencies, in order to agree on an ambitious plan for efficiency and prioritization. But our priority is absolute and it's clear. We will continue doing everything we can to provide life-saving aids to those in urgent need, and we'll continue our efforts to diversify the pool of generous donors who support our work. So I think that's really, he has been giving really, you were asking about the UN system. I think you'll find the integrated and approach to the situation and to what we need to be doing. We are doing already. And I think our colleagues in the agencies, of course, can be more specific. But in terms of the system, that's how we are working. Gabriela, you have a follow-up.
Yes. Thank you, Alessandra. Well, I don't know if it's exactly a follow-up, but it's another question. Is there any statement or comments by the Secretary General or a Human Rights a High Commissioner about the treatment that Mr. Zelensky received at the White House with Donald Trump? It's a UN state member that treated, mistreated, I don't know how to say in English, by the government of the USA, by not the government, by Donald Trump. So what do you think about that treatment? I mean, we all saw that. Is that the way to treat a chief of state that is in a war, that is vulnerable? I don't know if you have something to say about that.
Well, I'll quote the spokesperson of the Secretary General who, answering a question very similar to yours, said, I don't believe it was a particularly productive moment. Let me just be doing a little bit of housekeeping. Who's asking question to Jean-Martin so that we can free him if it's not the case? Nina, you have a question for Jean-Martin. Okay, go ahead.
It was connected to what you were saying about the importance of forecasting and weather forecasting when it comes to the situation in Somalia. And I'm wondering, sorry to bring everything back to the U.S., but wondering about who is handling the forecasting in Somalia, and then also if Claire is online. I had a question for her about that as well, because NOAA has seen huge firings and has also apparently been kicked out of the building where it conducts all of its forecasting. So it would be good to know, you know, how concerned you are about that. If the forecasting isn't as reliable as it has been, what impact will that have?
Okay, I'll start with Jean-Martin, but I think Claire is on the, she was on the line. Let me see. So Jean-Martin, you want to start, and then I'll go to Claire if she's still here.
Look, what we're saying here is that according to the IPC, and this is not NOAA, this is a system that exists in the humanitarian space to do the analysis in terms of household food security and humanitarian contexts. We think there will be 1 million more people facing acute food insecurity very quickly. This is something we need to deal with. This is a clear signal that that something needs to change, because we have two consecutive droughts. We have a very low funding in the country and a high level of vulnerability. Now, the indications about the drought, they come from our partners. We look at different models that are from different countries that point towards the same conclusion, which is that we fear that there will be a third season with insufficient water in southern Somalia, exacerbating these impacts. Of course, what you're pointing to is the importance of data for decision making, and it is essential that humanitarians have access to information. This is, again, the bread and butter of my work, definitely.
writing to Claire, because I think she has stepped down, asking her if she can reconnect. If she does, Nina, I'll give her the floor on that, but for the moment she's not on the platform. So again, let me start, let me ask who has questions for Jean-Martin. Is for WFP, Paula Dupraz, is Genius Solutions?
Yes, actually it is sort of a follow-up to Nina's question, and also to the question that I had to WHO. As you are an analyst on food in Somalia, and probably are working closely with people in information management, just wondering, as I also had seen that there were a number of postings recently for an IM manager in Somalia, what the situation is there. I mean, who do you work with, you know, in terms of other partner organizations? You know, has that role been filled? Are you sort of downscaling, you know, due to these cuts from the US and elsewhere? Just like to know what the situation is for IM in your region.
Thanks, Paula. I can't comment on that specific vacancy, but what I can tell you is that we work very closely with government, with the Somalia Food Security and Nutrition Analysis Unit, and other agencies based in country to ensure that we have the best data available. The numbers I mentioned today, they're again released by the IPC, which is a group of 19 agencies that collaborates, that shares information, and that does joint analysis. It's one of the real strengths of the humanitarian community in the country, and I can tell you that mechanism remains functional and is there to ensure we're on the right path with the response. Thank you.
Thank you. And Nina, I've just had an answer from Claire that she had to go to a meeting and she'll deal with questions in writing if you can write to her. Antonio Broto, Spanish News Agency.
Thank you. My question is not for WFP, it's for you, and it's like a follow-up of what Gabriela asked before.
Okay, wait a second, please. John, is that question for Jean-Martin? John, can you unmute yourself, please?
Yes, it is for Jean-Martin. Go ahead, Alessandra. Then. Yes, Jean-Martin. You just mentioned the IPC assessments. Can you give us the date that this IPC update on Somalia was made? And if you have any idea how much of the country is possibly falling under IPC phase 5 and how much is in IPC phase 4? Thank you.
Okay. So this data was released in February. This is a recent release. What we have is in the 3+, which is the humanitarian phases in Somalia, it's about 23% of the population forecast to be in phases 3 and above between the months of April and June. So that's a significant percentage. Right now, the current is 3.4 million.
Thank you very much. Jean-Martin, I think I can free you because the last question from Antonio, I understand, is not for you, but you are welcome to stay, of course, and thank you very much for this briefing.
Thank you for
answering. Sorry, John has a follow-up for you. Sorry. John.
Sure.
Yeah. You mentioned IPC and above and an average of 23. If I recollect correctly in the past, there were pockets where it was IPC 4 and there were pockets where it was bordering on IPC 5 in the past. So
absolutely.
Do we have pockets where we don't play the law of averages, where it's really bordering on catastrophic famine? Thank you.
So John, according to the latest data we have, we're not there yet now. We were there in 2022. There was a fear that we would reach phase 5 conditions for many people. If I recall correctly, it was hundreds of thousands of people in Somalia threatened by IPC phase 5. We're not there yet. The numbers are better. As I said, back in 2022, it was 6.7 million people in the IPC 3+, some of whom were in IPC 5. Right now, we're at a projection of 3.4 projected to increase by a million to 4.4. But with all the risk factors at play, we need to be careful. We need to watch this place closely. We need to make sure that there are resources in the pipeline to provide assistance early to avert a situation that could look like 2022.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Jean-Martin. I think this is really the last one question. Thank you again for briefing the journalists.
Thank you.
As I recall that you were calling in from Rome. Antonio, you have a question for me?
Yes, I would like to know if the United Nations has any reaction or may react to the U.S. decision to suspend military aid to Ukraine.
Look, I don't have any official reaction for the moment. I think we will look into it during the day. What I can tell you is, in general, the Secretary General has expressed himself several times on the need to get to a peace, which is just in agreement with the UN resolutions, and everything that can go towards that end is welcome. Everything which is not going towards that end is a source of concern, of course, but I think we'll have an assessment during the day, and I'll come back to you on this as soon as I have it. And this actually brings me to, since I don't see any other question, to remind you that the Secretary General has arrived in Cairo yesterday. As you know, there is an extraordinary Arab League summit that is taking place today, which will focus is focusing on the situation in the Middle East, in particular in Gaza. In the stakeout to the press that I mentioned before, the Secretary General spoke about the messages that he will convey to the attendees of the summit, and of course he will reiterate them today, that the ceasefire and hostage release deal must hold in light of the developments we see unfolding. He will also, on the margin of the summit, meet with leaders and officials in attendance. I think yesterday he met with Antonio Costa, and today he's scheduled to hold discussions with the president of the host country and have other bilaterals. I wanted to, the statement of the Secretary General will be webcast and it will take place this afternoon. I think it's 3:30 Geneva time, so you will have the possibility of following it on UN Web TV. I also have another couple of announcements. I think I won't repeat the committee announcements because I gave them to you last time. I haven't changed that much. The list of the countries is the same. But I wanted to remind you that on Wednesday, the 5th of March at 3 p.m., OHCHR Special Rapporteur on the Right to Adequate Housing will talk to you about the issue of who benefits from a manufactured migration crisis and what has that to do with the housing crisis. This press conference is embargoed until the 7th of March at 1 p.m. with the special rapporteur. The 5th of March is also, well, that's pretty timely, International Day for Disarmament and Non-Proliferation Awareness. We have distributed to you the message of the Secretary General where he says that on this International Day, he urges leaders to strengthen the systems and tools that prevent the proliferation, testing, and use of deadly weapons and live up to their disarmament obligations. He also called for a concerted effort in meeting the disarmament commitments contained in the recently adopted Pact for the Future. He concludes by saying, it's time for leaders to put words into action and invest in disarmament solution and the peaceful future every person deserves. Two more announcements, and then I'll give you the floor. I've seen some hand up. The first one is for an intergenerational dialogue on Beijing Plus 30 for all women and girls, rights, equality, and empowerment. As you may remember, 30 years ago, the Beijing Platform of Action was adopted, so we want to commemorate this important anniversary with this intergenerational dialogue, which will take place at the Palais on the 7th of March at 1 p.m. until 2:30 in room 19. This is organized by UN Women, UNOG, and the delegation of European Union together with other partners. And you will see in the list of speakers, we have our Director General, Ambassador Jürg Lauber, the president, permanent representative of Switzerland, president of the Human Rights Council for this year, High Commissioner Volker Türk, and the list of other speakers you will find in the invitation that we have shared with you. Last but not least, on the 11th of March at the Auditorium Ivan Pictet at the Gradet Institute, our colleagues of the UN Special the Office of the UN Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflicts is launching a global campaign entitled "Provit Matters." This is to uphold the spirit and letter of the Convention on the Rights of the Child and bring the voices of children up front. The campaign strives to inspire collective action, engaging the voices and participation of children, and promote long-term solutions that uphold the rights and well-being of conflict-affected children. There will be the mayor of Geneva talking at this event, the prime minister of Andorra, Mrs. Virginia Gamba, and other speakers. You have received, I think, the invitation. And very, very last, I forgot to tell you, we spoke about it last briefing, but just to remind you that today there will be a press briefing for the global launch of the International Narcotics Control Board annual report. This is going to happen in Vienna, but you can follow the press conference online on the UN Web TV, and we have sent you the media advisory, and colleagues say that you can get the report. Just ask them, there will be no problem. I think that's all I had. Sorry, in the meantime, we have received the information about the meeting of the Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel. They will hold a public hearing from 11 to 12 March, gathering testimony from victims of sexual, reproductive, and other forms of gender-based violence committed by the Israeli security forces and Israeli settlers. These hearings, I don't know if you remember the format from past edition, they will take place here at the Palais des Nations. They will be broadcast live. They're open to accredited media, but you have to register on our platform. You've received the invitation from the High Commissioner's Office. That's really it. Emma.
Last question, I promise. You mentioned Guterres was doing bilaterals whilst he's over in the Middle East. Will he meet with Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff? And is that channel open? Thank you.
From what I understand from my colleagues, there are contacts. Of course, we continue keeping contacts with U.S. authority. As you know, we have an office in Washington and the director of that office, but also other people, lots of high-level officers go regularly and speak regularly to the U.S. authorities. For the specific question about the summit in Egypt, I don't have the list of the bilats, but we will inform you as if we get them during the day. I have seen other hands. Gabriela.
Thank you. Thank you, Alessandra. Follow up on that question, on Emma's question. Mm-hmm. The meeting in Cairo, are they going to discuss this idea of doing a Gaza touristic resort? And another question on the narcotics report, are we going to be able to ask questions? That's it.
Sorry, I didn't get your second question. Are you going to be able to? What did you say?
To ask questions during the press conference.
The narcotics one or the one on the HSC? The narcotic ones?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, as such, my answer would be no, because it's on web, on the web TV, so you don't have an interaction. If you wish to participate more actively in the press conference, I can ask my colleagues in Vienna if it's possible. I don't have that link, but we can ask if some of you want to participate in the link that they will have. That is maybe possible. So what concerns the meeting in Gaza, the only thing I can tell you is what the Secretary General said about what he's going to say. The Secretary General welcomes and strongly supports the Arab-led efforts to mobilize support for the reconstruction of Gaza. In his participation, he will also emphasize that there is no sustainable reconstruction without a clear and principled political horizon. This is what I have on what he will discuss. For the rest, you will have to ask or listen to the proceedings. If there are, yes, Jamie?
Hi, Alessandra, thank you. I just wanted to follow up on your announcement about the COI on OPT that is going to be holding public hearings next week. I don't know if you're going to be able to answer this, but I would like to know, or at least put the question down on the record, maybe for somebody in OHCHR to answer, whether or not sexual abuse and other violence against Israelis who either on October 7th or in custody of Hamas and other militant groups in Gaza will also be considered during that meeting?
Of course, I can't speak for human rights. What I can tell you is that if you look at the invitation, there is a specific reference to sexual and reproductive attacks on sexual and reproductive health care facilities. There is a clear reference. They actually focus on sexual and gender-based violence. So what this means in more concrete term, I think you will have to ask them, but we take a note of your question, remains on record, and I will share it with the colleagues at the OHCHR. Okay, so thank you very much, Missy. There are no other questions. So thank you very much for following this briefing, and I'll see you on Friday. Thanks.